Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A bipartisan Senate committee in charge of redrawing the state's electoral districts could move its draft of the U.S. House map to a floor vote tomorrow.
Right now, the Senate has a plan that is very fair, partisan-wise, for Congress.
Also tonight, once again, Florida lawmakers consider measures that would allow businesses to sue local governments over ordinances that could impose a fiscal impact.
Would that then allow a court to invalidate an ordinance simply based on the insufficiency of the business impact statement itself?
We'll also get the latest on how Florida's small businesses are coping with a severe personnel shortage and check out a legislative proposal to require insurance companies to provide hearing aids to folks under the age of 21. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers and their staff have been working to draft the next decade's congressional and state legislative district maps over the last few months. This week, the state Senate narrowed down several drafts to a single plan for both the U.S. House and its own chamber's districts. As Valerie Crowder reports, a committee will consider each plan tomorrow.
Every decade, states redraw their congressional and legislative districts to account for population changes. More people moving to Florida over the last 10 years has given the state a 28th U.S. House seat. A bipartisan state Senate committee is scheduled to vote on a plan Thursday that gives the GOP a 16-12 seat advantage over Democrats, based on the 2020 election results. Right now, the state's congressional delegation includes 16 Republicans and 11 Democrats. Redistricting data analyst Matthew Isbell says those numbers could change under the proposed map based on how well candidates perform in future elections.
In past elections, this plan has actually been more favorable for Democrats. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won 15 districts to Trump's 13. In the governor and Senate elections of 2018, we had 14 districts for Democrats and 14 districts for Republicans, so we had a perfect tie, which reflected how close those elections were.
Isbell says the math shows the map is pretty fair and balanced. If the committee approves the plan, then it would move to the Senate floor for a vote. After that, Senate leaders must hammer out differences between their plan and the House plan. Unlike the Senate plan, the House's proposed maps would give Republicans a greater advantage with 17-18 red districts.
And right now, the Senate has a plan that is very fair, partisan-wise, for Congress. And the House has at least one plan that's a pretty aggressive gerrymander. And so the question is now going to become, which of those two sides win out?
Then there's the state Senate district map. And the chamber's plan for its own districts got some pushback from Democrats. Orlando Senator Randolph Bracey took issue with a decision to stretch the state's blue Senate District 19 across Tampa Bay to pick up African-American voters in South St. Petersburg. That would result in the loss of a blue district nearby. Republicans argued the move was needed to meet the state's benchmark for majority-minority districts.
Obviously, we did it in District 19, but there could have been an opportunity to do it in the district next to it if if we didn't cross the bay.
The district next to it that Bracey's referring to would have been drawn solely within Hillsborough County. The subcommittee's staff director, Jay Farron, explained the decision to cross Tampa Bay was made to ensure that Black voters in southern Pinellas County weren't disenfranchised.
If we look at drawing it differently, I think we're looking at a situation where the Black voters would not be able to control the primary numerically, would not make up a majority of the primary turnout, and that would potentially constitute diminishment.
And that's something the courts would likely take issue with if the maps are challenged. The state Senate map under consideration would give Republicans a 23-17 seat advantage. Thursday, a bipartisan committee will vote on the draft. If approved, they'll randomly renumber the districts to comply with Supreme Court precedent. And the committee will vote on the renumbered map. After the map passes through committee, it'll head to the Senate floor for a vote. Each chamber is in charge of drawing its own districts, meaning whatever the Senate approves will take effect after the state Supreme Court gives it the green light. As for the U.S. House districts, those need both chambers' approval. I'm Valerie Crowder.
A plan that would allow local ordinances to get automatically blocked if they're challenged is moving ahead. The proposal goes hand in hand with another measure that would let businesses sue local governments over policies that cause a revenue loss of 15% or more. Lynn Hatter reports local government groups say the bill is better, but they're still worried about its impact.
Cities and counties would have to do a business impact analysis for proposed local ordinances, but under a change, they would not have to hire accountants or financial consultants. Attorneys' fees would also be capped at $50,000. Still, the proposal and its counterpart remain a point of concern for groups like the Florida League of Cities, the American Civil Liberties Union, and growth management organizations. They say the effect of the measure will prevent local governments from making the best decisions for the people they represent. ACLU of Florida lobbyist Rich Templin says a rewritten version of the measure is not as bad as it initially was.
Obviously, you guys have taken some major steps, so on behalf of all of us, thank you guys for the hard work.
But
if a single individual can, after the fact, simply file suit and then the county or city is compelled not to act on the lawfully passed ordinance, that's essentially giving a single individual a veto over what could have been a very popular majority-driven process.
Republican Senator Travis Hudson is the bill sponsor, and he's promising to keep working with groups like the League of Cities on additional changes. League lobbyist Becca O'Hara says the plan is improved, but there are still questions, especially when it comes to that business impact statement.
Does this mean that the data, the methodology, or the assumptions that are made by the local government and the business impact statement could be challenged by a plaintiff? And if the court agrees with the plaintiff's characterization of those data assumptions and methodologies, would that then allow a court to invalidate an ordinance simply based on the insufficiency of the business impact statement itself?
Other groups like Trish Neely's League of Women Voters say the bill still needs more work.
Why do we even have local government if we're going to allow businesses or individuals to tie their hands?
Neely says the plan represents political doublespeak by the legislature's majority. On one hand, Republicans often criticize the federal government for what they see as overreach. The bill, says Neely, is the state doing the same thing to local governments.
And in my mind, this is no different. Disabling our municipalities from exercising their powers under home rule, both under state and federal law, is just not a wise idea.
Democrats are also worried that the challenges would come from large corporations with businesses elsewhere, effectively allowing those entities to decide what's best for a community. Republican Senator Dennis Baxley notes small businesses are often the backbone of cities and counties. They pay taxes, and they're directly impacted by the policies approved by those city and county commissions. Businesses, says Baxley, are people too.
And yet they're asked to pay the bill. They're paying the majority of the property taxes. The businesses is your friend. They're the people who give your community life, and for them to have no recourse and no way to go to demonstrate that they're being harmed in some way, I think is just unconscionable.
Hudson's proposal is part of an ongoing effort to curb local government powers amid blowback to decisions made early in the pandemic, like business shutdowns. I'm Lan Hatter.
A bill that would make it more expensive for residents of the Sunshine State to use solar panels on their roofs passed its first Senate committee hearing on the first day of session. Critics say the bill will gut the state's young solar industry by reducing the amount electric utilities pay to solar owners who sell excess power back to the grid. Raul Volguera is CEO of Cutler Bay Solutions. He says utility companies are wrong when they say all their customers subsidize rooftop solar by paying higher retail rates for the excess power.
Last year, $750 million were invested by solar customers into the infrastructure. Those $750 million strengthened our grid and made it more resilient. Nobody has to repay them for it. Nobody has to give it back to them. If the public utility companies, had they spent $750 million into building solar farms, which they are doing, and I applaud them for it, they do get reimbursed.
William Johnson started Sarasota solar company Brilliant Harvest 13 years ago and says if the bill passes, he'd have to lay off most of his employees.
We work in Peace River Electric Co-op territory, which is in eastern Manatee County. And in 2017, Peace River ended their net metering program. And I can assure you that since then, we have installed no new solar electric systems in that territory.
Utilities that back the bill say it's time to lower the amount utilities pay solar as the number of solar users increases. About 1% of the state's residents have panels, but solar advocates say other states haven't raised rates until the number hit around 10%. Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers consider changes to the regulation of vacation rental properties.
I feel like we've really struck the need to enact fair preemption, but also allow the locals to have the ability to regulate where they need to.
Florida's small business community says things would be going really well for them if only they could hire enough people to do the work.
Over 48% of small business owners report having chronic job openings. That means jobs that they have not been able to fill for at least 3 months or more.
And hearing aids can be costly for families, but essential for kids. Lawmakers are looking into a plan to ensure insurance companies foot the bill.
For young children, this is the way we learn. What we see, what we hear.
The Florida legislature is making a return trip to vacation rental legislation. Gina Jordan reports on a long-running effort to determine how much say municipalities should have in regulating vacation rental properties.
It's an issue that's been around for a while, but this isn't your vacation rental bill of old. I really think that what we have here is a true balance in the force, and I believe you'll hear that from the stakeholders.
Zephyr Hills Republican Senator Danny Burgess filed the latest bill, which has an identical version in the House. The legislation takes away local government authority to regulate advertising platforms like Airbnb, preempting that to the state. It also requires those platforms to collect and remit taxes on certain transactions. Current law does not allow local ordinances or regulations that prohibit vacation rentals or that dictate the duration or frequency of those rentals.
I remember this issue from when I was in the House, and it was a war. And so I feel like we have some balance. I feel like we've really struck the need to enact fair preemption, but also allow the locals to have the ability to regulate where they need to.
Burgess's bill says local governments can require the registration of vacation rental properties and impose fines on those that don't comply. The registration fee may not exceed $50, and anyone advertising on vacation rental platforms must include certain information about the property and attest that the information is accurate. Lobbyist Jennifer Green, speaking on behalf of the travel booking website Expedia, offered support for the bill.
On the policy front, if the legislature wants a third party, like an advertising platform, to be collecting remaining taxes and, of course, regulating third party advertising platforms at the state level. We're in support of that.
Vacation rentals are licensed through DBPR, the Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation. Samantha Padgett with the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association says her group hasn't come out for or against the bill yet. She says they strongly support some of the provisions, like requiring advertising platforms to remit taxes and verify the state license number before a unit is posted for rent.
But we believe there are additional provisions that need to be addressed in this bill if it's really going to strike that true balance that Senator Burgess referred to. For example, there's no quarterly reporting to DBPR and no requirement for the sharing of the physical address of a unit. A license number can represent up to 75 different individual units, and without a physical listing of a particular address of a unit, this can make enforcement measures very difficult.
Padgett also objects to a provision that says an advertising platform is not liable if they adhere in good faith to what's required in the law or in their own terms of use.
I'm sure we would like to all set our own rules and our own terms of use, but this doesn't seem like a great way to ensure full compliance.
Padgett called the bill a good starting point. She told the Senate Regulated Industries Committee her group hopes to work with sponsors of the legislation as it moves through the committee process. I'm Gina Jordan.
The past 2 years have been tough and in some cases catastrophic for many businesses. But Bill Hurley, executive director of the Florida branch of the National Federation of Independent Business, says the overall situation has been improving lately.
The market is out there. Consumer demand, consumer expectations have returned across many segments, many sectors. One of the more frustrating conditions for a business owner, and that is not being able to provide the goods and services that your customers want.
Simply put, says Hurley, there still aren't enough employees to meet the demand. And just when it seemed COVID-crunched businesses were on the rebound, along came the Omicron variant. In some places, the highly transmissible virus has already forced some merchants to suspend operations entirely. Hurley says it's not clear if that's impacted Florida's ongoing worker shortage.
I don't know that we can attribute it directly to Omicron. We don't have that information, but what the NFIB can validate is that the number one challenge for the small business sector now remains workforce availability. Over 48% of small business owners report having chronic job openings. That means jobs that they have not been able to fill for at least 3 months or more.
So, says Hurley, a significant number of those businesses have had to make their workplaces more attractive to employees.
A very close number, 44% of small business owners in the last quarter have reported that they've increased compensation in order to try to attract workers to the workforce.
But Hurley acknowledges there is only so much small businesses can do on their own, so he's looking forward to the upcoming Florida legislative session.
There are a lot of things that the state could do. Any public policy that can help us make the workers that we do have more productive. Perhaps there are tax incentives that would make it more possible for small business owners to invest in technology that allow them to operate with a smaller workforce. We know that if the workforce doesn't return, we need to find ways to make every worker that is working a little bit more productive.
As serious as this sounds, Hurley expects the bright side is that state government finds itself in a position where it may be able to provide the kind of help he's talking about.
We are very fortunate to have state revenues looking very healthy, and it'll be a question of where the state invests that. We're going to be talking to them about making sure that our unemployment insurance reserve is built back up and is strong, so that we can face any changes in the economy. We're also going to encourage them to take another look at the rent tax, where small business owners in Florida are the only business owners in the nation that pay a state sales tax on rents and leases. And the legislature has made some good progress on that in the past few years, and we'll probably encourage them to take another look at continuing that good work.
Work that Florida lawmakers will continue at least until the scheduled end of session on March 11th. Not all the action is in Tallahassee this week, of course. A report released this week details how sheriff's departments across the country are taking ethically questionable campaign contributions. WMNF's Ariel Stevenson reports Pinellas County is among them.
The D.C. watchdog group Common Cause and Communities for Sheriff Accountability released The Paid Jailer, How Sheriff Campaign Dollars Shape Mass Incarceration. The report is the culmination of 1 year of research documenting 48 sheriffs across 8 states. Donations, they say, are ethically conflicted, often came from businesses that stand to gain from elections. Beth Rotman, director of Money, Politics, and Ethics for Common Cause, says this system encourages higher incarceration.
This is a system that has incentivized jailing more people and giving enormous contracts, including healthcare contracts and contracts to build more jails, and contracts for healthcare that provide inadequate care.
The report highlights Pinellas Sheriff Bob Galtieri and the company G4S contracted to transport inmates. G4S is a Florida-based paramilitary private security firm that donates to Galtieri through the Wackenhut PAC. The company's late founder, George Wackenhut, was a former FBI agent. In 2013, G4S transported inmate Thomas Morrow, who was beaten by another Pinellas inmate, until he went into a coma and later died. Max Rose, one of the report's researchers, spoke more about Galtieri.
G4S does transportation for Sheriff Galtieri between the jail and the courthouse, and at least 2 people have died in their custody under really suspect circumstances.
A 2019 USA Today interview with Morrow's wife Sharon notes she holds the company and police responsible for her husband's death. During last year's elections, Wackenhut PAC donated $1,000 to Galtieri's campaign and $5,000 to a supporting committee. That's after another Pinellas inmate, Luis Nieves, died under G4S supervision in 2018. Rose says that didn't stop Galtieri from contracting with them again.
So despite very questionable conduct, reports that have not been released or made transparent, from what we can tell, G4S remains under the employ of the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office.
Sheriff Galtieri declined to comment for this story. To learn more about the report, visit thepaidjailer.org. I'm Ariel Stevenson.
Here's a follow-up to a story we reported last night on Capitol Report. New legislative proposals that seek to prevent doctors from performing abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy were met with swift opposition today from Democrats and abortion rights groups. The measures closely resemble a Mississippi abortion law that's before the U.S. Supreme Court, which heard arguments last month. With a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, abortion rights supporters are concerned that justices will uphold the Mississippi law or strike down the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade abortion ruling. A group of Democratic lawmakers and activists supporting abortion access decried the Florida legislation today during a news conference on the steps of the old Capitol, calling the bills oppressive and dangerous. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, access to hearing aids can have a significant impact on the lives of kids who are hearing impaired. But sometimes cost can limit that access. Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers are looking into a measure that would require private insurance companies to provide hearing aid coverage for people through the age of 21.
I love my hearing aids because I finally know what everything sounds like.
Joey Schofield and his mom, Laura, recently spoke during a committee meeting of lawmakers in the Florida Capitol building. Laura says while having hearing aids has been important for her son, they're a difficult expense for her family.
On top of our insurance premiums, the $5,000 plus charge is an incredible extra expense to cover the hearing aids when they're not covered through the insurance company.
Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley has a bill that would require private insurance companies to cover hearing aids for people through the age of 21. Under Baxley's bill, insurance companies would be required to provide a minimum coverage limit of $3,500 per year within a 24-month period for an eligible child. The measure also includes a provision that would require a new 24-month period to begin if a child experiences a significant or unexpected change in their hearing. Baxley says the measure would help 461 children who are currently living in Florida.
For young children, this is the way we learn, what we see, what we hear. And having a blind son has really sensitized me to the importance of opening the doors of opportunity for every one of these children who are impaired to have whatever we can do for them to help them get there.
Baxley says this isn't the first time he's carried the bill and admits the issue has faced some pushback in the past.
It's the door that's being opened on hearing aids. And guys my age, going to be 70 this summer, I might need a hearing aid or two. And so you get into a wide scope of people as those kind of hearing losses come later in life.
Baxley says this time he thinks his measure will avoid that concern because it's focused specifically on children. But during a committee meeting, St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis said he's hesitant to add another item to the list of things insurance providers must cover.
I'm always, always kind of hesitant to add more things to what we require insurance policies to cover because there's kind of no end to what the legislature ultimately could add to that. I would like for us to consider as a state to set up a program for kids with hearing loss.
Brandis says rather than ensuring children have hearing aids by making it a requirement that insurance companies provide coverage for them, he'd like to create a state fund to give families the money to buy the devices.
The Baxley Hearing Aid Fund sounds like a great opportunity for the state and for kids. And I think that we could come, instead of kind of doing a backdoor requirement or a fee that we're requiring everybody in the state to pay, I think we can find a way through the state to come up with a fund to help support these kids, contract with a few of the children's hospitals, and support them.
That's something other members of the committee said they'd support. But they also pointed out kids need hearing aids now, and Baxley's bill is the one that's before them. Baxley said there could be time to make changes before the end of the legislative session. The measure as it stands now received full support from the committee, including a yes vote from Brandis. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Gina Jordan, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Brett Rutherford. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again each weeknight throughout the 2022 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flafl-cio.org.